Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, it's deep of winter, but the Occupy movement prepares for a spring offensive. Haiti, still suffering from earthquake and occupation 2 years later. And plenty of folks are invoking the name of Martin Luther King, but what would he do today?
But first, the U.S. Census predicts that people of color will outnumber whites in the United States by the year 2042. And Boston, United for a Fair Economy, conducted a study of what the American future would look like with a non-white majority. Study co-author Tim Sullivan says blacks in 2042 will be making about 61 cents for every dollar whites earn, which is about where it's been for the past 30 years.
That's exactly right. It's gone up and down a little bit, but it's always been around that amount. I think the high point was maybe 62 cents, you know, going back really as long as the numbers have been tracked.
So we're looking forward to a future that looks very much like our past.
Well, it does in one regard, in that the divide in income and wealth and across a whole variety of economic indicators will be similar, except the difference is that the population is going to be much less white than it is now, and certainly much less white than it was in 1980 or back at the time of the Civil Rights Movement. So the major difference to that is that if poverty rates, for example, remain close to double white poverty rates for both blacks and Latinos, it's going to be just massive numbers of people in poverty and joblessness. Again, the numbers will be massive. So really what will happen is that the economy won't be able to sustain it at some point in the future.
That is, we have a consumer-based economy, and if we have a majority of the consumers living at such low levels of consumption, well, that's a different kind of economy.
That's exactly right. We simply won't be able to sustain our standard of living or place in the world that the majority of the white population expects. We will cease to be a world leader by not dealing with the racial economic divide. It's been for generations a travesty that we haven't. It's, on a moral and ethical level, it's a national embarrassment. But as the population, like I said, becomes less white, it'll become impossible to bear economically, headed towards a apartheid-style economy.
I was about to say that. It sounds like we would be moving in this space and time from a period in which oppressed minorities are in economically bad straits to a situation like South Africa, in which the majority is in severe economic straits.
That's exactly right. That's what we're headed towards. I want to be clear that future is not necessary. It's not the future that we have to have. The current racial wealth divide, a racial economic divide, is a result of public policy decisions. Centuries of racial oppression have gotten us to this point. And really, since the late 60s, we've begun ignoring race in public policy. It's after the Voting Rights Act. As an example, there was a real shift that has sort of taken race out of our politics, and people running for president not even acknowledging it, or to the degree that they are, they're disavowing the idea that anything should be done about race.
And in fact, President Obama has said a rising tide lifts all boats.
Right, exactly. And that actually comes from the policies of another Democratic president, John F. Kennedy, as where that saying got popularized. To some degree, there is some truth in it. If we have a robust and growing economy, there will be some improvement in racial justice, racial economic equality, but it will mostly benefit the people who are already doing well. It will, to some degree, improve a bad situation for poorer and blacker communities. On the whole, it just that approach benefits white people so much more.
Now, you project that by 2042, Latinos would be earning only 45 cents on the dollar. That's compared to 61 cents for blacks. Why are Latinos of the future falling so far behind?
Well, in the model that we used, we looked at the trends for the last 30 years and then projected them 30 years forward to 2042, which is the year that the Census Bureau predicts that the white population will slip below 50%. So essentially what we're looking at is the decline in earnings that's happened over the course of the last 30 years. And when you look at the Latino populations, one of the two major factors are, one, immigration, which has decreased wages. And it's decreased wages for Latinos, not for the country as a whole, and that's because as more working class immigrants come in, the average gets pushed down. The other factor is that while there's always been a sort of anti-immigrant thread to American history, the boom in Latino immigration and to a lesser degree Asian immigration has really tied together anti-immigrant and racist sentiments. And if you look at, you know, some of the graphs in the report, which I should mention is available for download at faireconomy.org/dream, there's sort of a convergence in the economic situation for blacks and Latinos around the 1990s. And what we're seeing there is that what was sort of a division from immigrant communities and black communities converged, and we ascribe that to the overlap between anti-immigrant and racist sentiments.
You make projections in terms of mass incarceration as well. We refer to it as mass black incarceration today. It looks like it remains mass black incarceration in 2042.
Yeah, if the current trends continue, I mean, it's already staggering. It's the first thing. And if the current trends continue, it I believe will be close to 5% of the black population will be in prison, not to have a prison record. Those numbers would be even more staggering. And in fact, we're potentially even understating it because we're comparing it to the population as a whole, not the adult population in this case. So the number of adults, the percentage of adults in prison, it's just mind-boggling, and it's largely the result of the war on drugs, which, again, we talk about what 2042 might look like. If we change course politically, if our policies take a direction towards racial equity, we will end the war on drugs, and we'll have a real chance at least beginning to turn around the prison boom for blacks, and to a lesser degree, but still a significant degree for Latinos as well.
And if there is any statistic, any disparity that looks insurmountable, it is the gap in wealth. What's 2042 look like in terms of black wealth?
It's quite dire. The trend over the last 30 years has been that black wealth is decreasing relative to white wealth. There are certainly examples, and I should say within all races and ethnicities, there's an enormous amount of diversity. There are rich people and poor people in every demographic group, but on the whole, there's been an increasing of the gap. The situation's been getting worse for wealth, whereas with some of the other factors you mentioned, income, there's been some slight improvement over the last 30 years in income between black and white. It's been very small, but there's been some. In terms of wealth, the situation's been getting worse. If that's carried forward for another 30 years, it'll be just pennies on the dollar that both black and Latino communities hold compared to white communities.
You are projecting a country that, based on the models that you use, will not be economically sustainable. At least the kind of economy that we have today cannot be sustained with the figures that you've projected for 2042. And a demographic that is quite different than today, with the traditionally oppressed groups amounting to a majority of the population. That seems like a politically unsustainable scenario as well.
It is. And at some point, things will have to change one way or another. Either, as we were discussing, we'll have to move into an apartheid type of system with even more direct control than we have now, or the politics and power in the country will have to shift. That shift, that would be the positive outcome. And it won't happen merely by achieving a majority. It's wealth, and it really, to a very large degree, is power, especially the way that our political system is set up with the influence of money in politics and public policy responding far more to the opinions and whims of the rich and powerful than to the majority. So that needs to change, and alliances really need to be built not just based on race, but across economic lines, which is actually something that gives us hope in this time of extraordinary inequality from top to bottom and the rise of some of the Occupy protests, that there's a real opportunity to link the fate of Black and Latino communities with the fate of the increasingly shrinking white middle class.
So the lesson is there is no magic in majorities. The people must still organize.
That's exactly right.
Every day we hear about the United States' present healthcare system is broken. Will it be fixed? Do you project in 2042?
No, absolutely not. The healthcare law that was passed in 2009 will do some good. It will reduce some of the disparities in health insurance coverage, but its structure is extremely conservative and it leaves most of our private insurance system in place. So it doesn't do a significant job of reducing health outcome disparities and access to care. It's an advancement. It's better than what was in place previously, but it leaves so much in place that a lot of the disparities will persist, particularly for Latinos.
That was Tim Sullivan, co-author of the new report, State of the Dream, 2012, The Emerging Majority.
Martin Luther King Day commemorations are in full swing, with preachers and politicians invoking the slain leader's name to boost their own causes. In Columbia, South Carolina, activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray says folks should check out Dr. King's words for themselves.
If people want to find out and know what Dr. King was thinking beyond the dream as realized at Pennsylvania Avenue, there's Where Do We Go From Here, The Other America, The Time to Break the Silence. There are a number of speeches that lay out what Dr. King was about ideologically, where he stood as it related to war and peace, where he stood as it related to this empire, the United States of America being the greatest purveyor of violence in the world at a time when this country, allied or through its surrogate in Israel, is trying to provoke a war in Iran, is trying to carry on war in Afghanistan, is engaged in something far worse than torture, assassination, holding people without rights, known as terrorists, rightless people. And Black people ought to understand from the legacy of slavery what a rightless person means. Everything that's going on in this country, to this idea of the president signing the National Defense Authorization Act, which gives one person in this country the power to imprison somebody without due process, without seeing his accusers, without seeing the evidence, the idea that Black folk are now supporting the idea of preemptive war and preemptive assassination, that there is one person who makes the law, that's above the law, and this idea of being against vulture capitalism, crony capitalism, or Wall Street socialism. It's all the same thing. Or the idea that because we have these super rich Black people that practice elite capitalism, that all of a sudden Dr. King's dream is realized. Well, that is not the case. And if Black folk are content to be quiet while they wait to vote for Barack Obama, as unemployment numbers get worse, as the housing crises in the Black community gets worse, as schools around the country seek to resegregate, and the president himself, through his charter school program, seeks to have a school system that discriminates against people. If that is what they think Dr. King's dream is, then they're all mad.
And yet, in all the church pulpits across America today, this Martin Luther King season, people will be invoking Dr. King.
Look, churches all across America, Black churches all across America, got a picture of Dr. King on the wall. And most Black preachers, if somewhere in America, some preacher is going to do I Have a Dream. Now, if they went back and, as I said, read what Dr. King said about racism, about militarism, about poverty, and talked about concrete steps to challenge this Darwinian culture that we live in, where the corporations run government, and where we're no longer governed by the rule of law, where all people are equal, that's what they need to be reading. and they need to figure out how to reorganize our community politically, how to get down on the local level and build new organizations that are based on the principles that Dr. King talked about in all of his speeches, not just I Have a Dream speech, that talked about another America, building the beloved community. That's what they ought to be about instead of just showboating and mouthing the words of a martyred man.
This conversation about peace and against corporate rule isn't taking place in the Democratic Party, but it is being put forward by the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Well, the Occupy Wall Street movement has to figure out, because it is a predominantly white movement, is it just about their anguish over their lost expectation of privilege, or is it about eroding white supremacy and white male hegemony in this country? Because you see a lot of folks stand up and talk about Occupy, but how do you do that door-to-door organizing and really relate to people's problems? How do you make allies with the most oppressed in communities? How do you help build the beloved community instead of thinking that you just basically, it's your turn to lead?
Is it that people have forgotten how to build a movement because it's been such a long time, or are there active forces in the black community resisting the building of a movement?
Look, the system is designed to maintain the system, and anything and anybody that gets into that system is going to do the bidding of that system. That's just it. That's just the way it is. We have to build beyond that and build a grassroots movement and change consciousness, which is another good thing about what Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Movement is doing. The first step in movement building is consciousness raising. And then it's how do we build beyond just an election season? And if we want to change the electoral process, what is meaningful electoral change? Is it cumulative voting structures? Is it a multi-party system? Is it a different kind of system? And let's talk about how do you make that happen? Even if you want to talk about getting money out of politics and attacking Citizens United, well, how do you do that? How do you have a constitutional amendment, which you get into conversations about the First Amendment and free speech, how do you actually change that to get money out of politics? Those are the things that we really need to be moving toward acting on. What is change with substance? It was easy with the civil rights movement when you're trying to desegregate a lunch counter or desegregate a school or make sure that someone judges your job application, at least you can apply for the job. And those are tangible things. So what kinds of tangible things are we talking about? Are we talking about free public education and free college education? Are we talking about a nationalized banking service? Are we talking about restitution, reparations? Are we talking about debt forgiveness for school loans and maybe for some folks who are stuck in the housing crises? Are we talking about putting money in infrastructure in the inner cities? What are we talking about? Those are the things that people have to get important about, because those are tangible things that people can understand, as opposed to we've got to fix the system.
Ed, it seems that what most black politicians and black preachers are talking about is simply the reelection of this president.
Well, that's all they know to talk about. And then, of course, if you talk about anything else in this environment, the way black folk will bash you because they want to be accepted by whites and white society. And to a large extent, Barack Obama is a personification of that acceptance. They'll fight to protect that. So it's not even about the politics. It's not even about the fact that he will take their children to war with Iran. It's just about the idea that you're running the empire, or you think you're running the empire, because you ain't running nothing.
Kevin Alexander Gray is author of The Decline of Black Politics, From Malcolm X to Barack Obama.
Activists occupying Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. are gearing up for a mass mobilization on March 30th. The Freedom Plaza occupation has been in continuous operation since last October 6th and had been in the planning for months. However, a recent Associated Press story described the encampment as having started out as an anti-war protest that somehow morphed into an occupation. That's not how Occupy Washington, D.C. organizer Kevin Zies remembers it.
That's exactly wrong. That is not the real history, and I think you probably know it since you were around us in the beginning. If you go back to June 4th when we announced this occupation, we said that we'd be occupying Freedom Plaza until we thought the time was right to leave, until we've done our job here. And the initial targets were corporatism and militarism. We started on October 6th because it was two things. First, it was the first week of an austerity budget, federal budget, for everything except militarism. And second, it was the day of the 11th year, beginning of the 11th year of the Afghanistan war. We thought it was an opportunity to tie together the austerity that Americans are facing, the lack of money being put into getting the economy going, and the military budget drowning us and sucking up all the money that the country had. And so that was an opportunity to bring all these issues together, connect the dots for everybody. But we always have been a group that's focused on ending corporatism. In fact, our primary slogan, as far as a phrase goes, is end corporate rule, shift power to the people. And that was true on the first day. You can go back to October 6th in the speech I gave at Freedom Plaza, and I said that specifically was our goal, and it was always our goal from the beginning.
And now the winter's set in. How is that affecting your operations?
It actually turned into an opportunity because when we started to look at the winter, we started to think about what we want to do next. And so we entered into this phase two of the occupation. We now have, in addition to Freedom Plaza, we have two houses. One house called the Peace House is in Washington, D.C., and is working on a very important project, the National Occupation of Washington, which begins on March 30th, which will be a combination of a social forum, an Occupy social forum where people will share ideas and information, and a protest, a civil resistance against the powers that be in Washington, D.C. So that's one project. The other project we developed is in another house, Mount Rainier, just on the border with Maryland, and that project is focused on Occupy the economy, where we're creating alternative economic solutions, economic systems like worker-owned co-ops. This happens to be the International Year of the Co-op, according to the UN, and so worker-owned co-ops is one thing we're focusing on, to provide money to ongoing occupiers, as well as to provide money to the movement, and to provide a model for Americans to see that they can create their own jobs and their own wealth.
Well, when people hear the term National Occupation of Washington, and that starts on March 30th, they think of a new period of massing lots of people.
That's right, and that's our goal. We're inviting occupiers from across the country to participate. We have a team that's reaching out. Each group person has a region they're responsible for, reaching out to occupiers, reaching out to colleges, reaching out to local media, unions, et cetera, to involve them in the National Occupation of Washington beginning on March 30th.
Now, these two houses, how is that a different kind of approach?
The difference with the occupy movement, first off, is we're not in a public space. And I think we want to get across the point to everybody that occupy is more than just occupy in public space. We have a long-term goal. We saw the occupation of public space as a tactic, much like a lunch counter sit-in. The goal of lunch counter sit-in was not to be able to sit at that lunch counter. The goal of occupying a public space is not to have a tent in a public park. The goal of occupying public space is to organize, mobilize, and educate people, and to start a debate about the wealth divide and how we have to reshape our economy so it's a fair economy and not an unfair economy that shifts money to the top 1%. We need an economy for the American people, the 99%, not for the 1% and the oligarchy.
We saw a rather amazing spectacle last week and this week with Republican presidential contenders attacking Mitt Romney using language that sounds like, almost like 99% language.
No, I think we're affecting the debate. You can look at it in polls. I've seen numerous polls that have pointed out changes in public opinion that are focused on the wealth divide, the unfair economy, the divide between the rich and poor, and how we actually don't actually have the same goals, and how we actually there is a division between us. These are all new ideas that you wouldn't have seen in polls before. We've seen President Obama talking like he's an occupier, while he puts, of course, his actions don't kind of support that. You know, he just replaced J.P. Morgan, chief of staff, with a Citigroup chief of staff. And we're seeing that Republicans even use the language. So it's very interesting to see the debate change and our impact. And this is at a very early stage. We're just a few months old.
I think when you get to the American Spring next year, you're going to see a much bigger and deeper occupation, a lot more anger, because the economy is remaining stagnant. Unemployment is going to remain high. It's only decreasing, by the way, because of the long-term unemployed who are no longer counted as part of the unemployed, even though they want jobs and want to work. And so the economy is going to remain stagnant, going to remain unfair. The wealth divide will continue. We'll see a lot of bonuses for bankers again when those come out. And so the anger will not subside. And so I think what you've seen in the first 2 months is just the beginning. And I think I'll give the Occupy, by the way, the credit for stopping Congress and that super committee from going forward with cutting Social Security and Medicare, as they were planning on doing, as Obama was planning on doing, working with the Republicans. But that got stopped because the protests that we put forward and plans that we put forward as an alternative to cutting social programs. And so I think we've already had a pretty significant impact, and I think we're just getting started.
And this will be the first presidential election year in the presence of a popular movement in how many decades?
That's exactly right. Really, in, I'd say, since the 60s, late 60s. And I would say that the goal of our movement during the presidential election is two things. First, continue to build an independent movement that will challenge both parties. And I say that's important because no matter who gets elected president, Romney or Obama, both will be funded by Wall Street, both will be corporate presidents, and we're going to have a movement that pushes no matter who's elected. So we have to build an independent movement and not get sucked into the presidential campaign. The second goal, I think, of the year is to have a strong enough message so that it becomes obvious that it's our message, that the conversation of the people is the real conversation, and the conversation being held by the two corporate candidates is a focus group, poll-driven, Madison Avenue-created fake conversation. So it's our job to show the people have the real conversation while the bought-up politicians are having a fake conversation, and continue to show the separation between the people and the government.
So this is a people's intervention in a corporate conversation.
Very well said. I'll have to remember that and use it, Glenn. That was said better than I said it. So, yes, a people's intervention into a corporate conversation, and hopefully the people's conversation will be the one that's heard as the real conversation.
That was Kevin Zeese at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C.
Billions of dollars were raised and spent in the name of Haitian recovery from an earthquake that killed more than 300,000 people 2 years ago this week. But Haiti is still a scene of devastation, presided over by foreign aid workers, foreign businessmen, and foreign soldiers. Don Beaton of the Center for Policy and Economic Research talks about conditions in the Western Hemisphere's poorest country.
You've got 500,000 people who are left homeless by this quake. A lot of those people are living in these internally displaced person camps where they have almost no access to sanitation. They don't have regular access to clean drinking water. And they're living in deplorable conditions. And so, this is really unacceptable. It's a real travesty that a full 2 years later that this kind of thing continues.
Haiti's been called the Republic of NGOs because there are so many private organizations there that ostensibly are providing the services that a government would provide. If it is the Republic of NGOs, how would you rate that form of government?
Well, I think it's been a real failure. I mean, with all these NGOs in Haiti, more NGOs per capita than any place else in the world, there should be no problem in fulfilling so many of these people's needs, right? I mean, needs for housing, for sanitation, making sure that women and girls who are living in these camps are safe and until they can be moved to some more viable temporary housing. These are all things the NGOs are supposed to be taking care of, and they've failed pretty horribly. You know, the cholera epidemic is another huge problem. It's still ongoing more than a year later after the UN brought cholera to Haiti and reintroduced it to the country after more than a century. And this is another area where NGOs consistently seem to be falling down on the job. Not all of them, but overall, we've seen NGOs cut back on cholera treatments and prevention efforts, and they seem to do this when the cholera cases drop with seasonal fluctuations. That is, when it's the dry season in Haiti, you're going to see less cholera cases emerging because the disease is not being transmitted as quickly as it is during the rainy season. And so the NGOs seem to see this as an opportunity to cut back. Well, cholera seems to be improving. it seems to be improving. It's just these fluctuations. The NGOs certainly ought to know better. I mean, this is their job. So as a form of government, I think it's a huge failure.
Why is MINUSTA, the armed occupation force of the United Nations, there when there is no civil unrest in Haiti? And in fact, their murder rate is about the world average.
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't know that anyone really has an answer. I mean, if you look at the justification for MINUSTA's presence there in Haiti, each year, you know, it has to be renewed. Their mandate has to be renewed by the UN Security Council. Well, over the years, you know, they've been there over 7 years now, and over the years, they've given different justifications, such as that they need to ensure safe and secure elections, and different reasons depending on what's happening in Haiti at the time. So it kind of seems to be a mission without a cause in a way, you know, no real justification for the presence, except that I think the international community, especially the United States, is threatened by the people of Haiti, and they, you know, they don't want to see the Haitian people take control of their own destiny and their own lives. I mean, we've seen whenever the Haitian people seem to be doing just that, when they've elected the people to office, the government's office that they want in free and fair elections, that there's been coups not long afterwards. So I can only think that this is really why MINUSTA continues to remain in Haiti.
From your observations, how do the Haitian people feel about the continued armed presence of the United Nations?
Well, we saw and we spoke to a lot of people in Haiti. I was down there as part of a delegation with School of the Americas Watch, and we talked to dozens and dozens of people from various groups, grassroots organizations, from political parties, from NGOs, kinds of different groups. We talked to journalists. Everybody had complaints about MINUSTA. And most people felt very strongly that they should leave. And we also saw a lot of the anti-MINUSTA graffiti that's all over Port Prince. We saw the way MINUSTA interacts with people on a daily basis. They demonstrated a pretty threatening posture just towards us, a bunch of Americans, you know, a bunch of white Americans. I can only imagine what it's like for Haitian residents to have to encounter these foreign troops on a daily basis when they're so bold and just being threatening to some very privileged visitors from the United States. You know, it's not surprising at all that I think people would want MINUSTA to leave. And of course, this year, especially the past year, we saw some pretty horrifying scandals emerge with UN troops raping Haitians and impregnating underage girls and things like that. I mean, I think the anger against MINUSTA in Haiti is really at a peak.
Dan Beaton of the Center for Policy and Economic Research in Washington.
The Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti took legal action against the United Nations for introducing cholera into the country. But Institute Director Brian Kankanen says the UN has been stonewalling.
The UN, after 7 weeks of reviewing our report, sent a three-sentence a letter saying that they were still studying it. The UN has continued to deny responsibility in public for the epidemic. They concede that they introduced it to Haiti, but they say that it's Haiti's weak infrastructure that caused the epidemic, which is like me going into a field of dry grass and lighting a fire, and when it turns into a forest fire, blaming the wind. The UN knew when it didn't test its soldiers coming into Haiti, when it didn't properly dispose of its human waste, it knew that Haiti was vulnerable to a cholera epidemic, and Haiti's weak condition should have been a reason for the UN to be more careful, not an excuse for not being careful.
That was Brian Kankanen at the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti.
President Obama oversaw a seven-month NATO bombing campaign against Libya and overthrew that country's government. But Cynthia McKinney, the former Georgia congresswoman and presidential candidate who led several fact-finding delegations to Libya, says American troops are lurking nearby.
The various news reports that I am seeing, one from an Algerian newspaper, and then several blogs that are paying very close attention to what happens in Libya now are indicating that 12,000 U.S. troops are temporarily way stationed in Malta awaiting the orders to descend into Libya. And that would be a truly sad situation if our president then would send troops of occupation into Libya.
Why would they have to occupy Libya, the side that they supplied and on whose behalf they bombed Libya for 7 months? One, don't they have control of the country?
The indication is that no, there is no real control by the National Transitional Council. And I just read a report that seems to be written by a Libyan woman who is saying, who are these people? They don't even live in Libya. They haven't lived in Libya. So they don't have the right to impose their will, and the most recent of which is an agreement that allows the stationing of international troops on Libyan soil.
You've described the situation in Libya as a kind of socio-side, that is, the society eating itself, because the various Libyan militias that the United States and its allies supported are now engaged in warfare with each other.
That's exactly correct. In fact, Dr. Yusuf Shakir, on whose television show many members of the Dignity delegation, including me, appeared, recently gave an interview where he talked about this phenomenon of the militias fighting each other. And because they're fighting each other so violently, the resistance doesn't really have much to do in many areas because they will just allow them to fight each other. And that's what's happening.
You also cite reports of the Misurata Brigade trying to seize control of the oil platforms outside the city of Brega and being attacked by Apache helicopters flown by NATO.
You have to understand that society has not returned to normal. It is not a situation like it was prior to the NATO intervention. The country has been ripped apart. The fabric of unity that kept the various personalities and tribes and all of that that constitutes the polity, that has been ripped asunder now, so people can do what they want to do, and they are armed. The people are desperate for jobs. They need work. And many of them are trained in the oil industry because that was, you know, sort of the mother's milk of Libya. That's what allowed the Jamahiriya to provide free health care, free education, subsidized cars, free and subsidized housing. The people apparently, and this was the Misurata Brigades, were trying to take to the platforms. After all, it is their country, but they were repelled by their former allies. Now, what I also have read on one of the websites, they make the point that the Libyan people are standing in line to get gas, but the ports are busy exporting their oil.
Cynthia McKinney speaking from Atlanta.
Michael Dorsey, a professor of environmental science at Dartmouth University, has just returned from South Africa. The site of a largely unsuccessful international conference on climate change. Professor Dorsey charges the U.S. with ecological genocide for putting off measures to slow global warming.
I think it's fairly simple to say that when negotiators from various countries know the consequences of unfolding climate change are worsening, they also know full well that the speed and rate at which unfolding climate change is happening is accelerating. When those things are known at the outset, and those same negotiators propose to come to the negotiating table 5 or 10 years from now to begin to put together an agreement that undoubtedly, just based on the past agreements, might not actually take place for another 5 or 10 years forward, might not begin to work for that period of time. So when negotiators say that they won't do anything essentially for 25 years, a generation, in the face of what they know full well is the unfolding problem that's worsening and speeding up. That kind of brinksmanship diplomacy, that kind of essentially backwards diplomacy, is really best characterized as a kind of apartheid for the planet, and particularly for Africa, where we know the unfolding climate change crisis will have catastrophic effects, is already playing out. We know that those on the margins, poor people, poor countries, marginalized peoples, both in poor countries as well as in wealthy countries, are impacted negatively first and harshest. We know these things, and we decide to delay action for essentially a generation or a couple of decades. That's just not irresponsible, but that's essentially sanctioning climate apartheid, and I think it's fair to call what's going on that. And actually, I think some of the leading journals concur with this position. Just after the talks in Durban, the leading journal Nature, the leading science journal, came out and said, it's about time we call out the politicos that are moving these negotiations essentially backwards and recognize that they are completely out of step with the scientific reality. They're out of step with how severe and how dangerous this problem is becoming. And anybody who doesn't call them out, Nature said, is engaged in a kind of collective Stockholm syndrome. And that was Nature's very, very strong commentary on the state of play after Durban.
It appears that you seem to have witnessed a huge stalling tactic.
Well, worse than stalling. Again, in this case, sometimes people think that doing nothing is indeed doing nothing. But in this case, doing nothing is a diabolical deed. Doing nothing will essentially aid and abet this problem to unravel faster and in more horrific ways than any kind of action. So in a sense, in this particular case, doing nothing is dangerous.
Many scientists warn that we are quickly reaching the point of no return, and Africa will reach that point, if it has not reached that point already, sooner than many other places.
Well, that's exactly the case. Africa is experiencing already the effects of the unfolding climate catastrophe that's on the planet. Increased storm intensity wreaks havoc on agricultural systems, wreaks havoc on economic systems that are already stressed in some of the poorest countries that happen to be concentrated in Africa. The stress on those agricultural systems, on economic systems, means stress on livelihood, means stress on populations, on people. So in Africa, we see already the deep downside consequences of delayed action. We see the downside consequences of the lack of adequate resources and funding to support communities that are seeing these problems already. And it just accelerates and snowballs in a place like Africa. And this is pretty much known. The United Nations has come out with statistics that say, essentially, we'll see somewhere between 100 to maybe as many as 200 million more displaced persons or new refugees. They're reluctant to call them climate refugees because of the legal sort of language wrapped up with calling somebody a refugee. But we already know that the accelerated and more intense storms that are a result of the unfolding climate crisis, those things displace people. Those things upend communities. They upend livelihoods. And an already difficult existence, all the much more harder. And not just harder, but indeed, those things can kill people, and they do.
And in fact, many observers say that the conflicts in places like Darfur and up and down the Sahel are rooted in climatic changes.
Indeed, the Secretary General has come out and said that we might have seen in Darfur the first sort of climate-instigated conflict. Whether or not that's the case is up for debate, and many are debating it. The fact is that climate change, as it unfolds, as it accelerates, as it worsens, as it produces molten storms, as it brings chaotic weather events across the continent, across Africa, but also across the world, it has deep negative consequences for communities, for livelihoods, for economies, for social systems, for political systems.
Were you encouraged or discouraged by the development of green movements in Africa?
I think the green movements in Africa is one of the most dynamic emerging movements that we need to pay attention to, particularly in the U.S., because they are the leading edge of thinking about how to get out ahead of the unfolding climate crisis, but also they're the leading edge in refashioning and reshaping politics on the ground in Africa, just like in the U.S. and like around the world, really. There's a tremendous concern by people in Africa about the environment, by those both that are slightly better off, you know, living in cities, but also people in rural areas, people that are not as well off. There's a tremendous amount of concern about protecting the environment, and people are, in effect, let us say, putting their money where their mouth is by putting pressure on their own governments, putting pressure on the U.S. There's been a tremendous amount of collaboration between some of the environmental groups in South Africa in particular, with U.S. groups to stop dirty oil development. There's a group in South Africa called Groundwork South Africa, and they work closely with groups in the U.S. like the Sierra Club and others to get out ahead of dirty fossil fuel development projects. And that's just not taking place only in South Africa, which is one of the wealthier countries in Africa, but you've got environmental groups coming on scene across the continent, in Mozambique, in Angola, in Kenya, in West Africa, in Nigeria, North Africa, across North Africa from Egypt all the way over to Morocco. You've got tremendous environmental social movements that not only are they emerging, but they've been on the scene for a generation. They haven't always gotten as much attention as they deserve in the press and in the media, but they're there, they've been there, and they are leveraging themselves in ways that probably we wouldn't even be able to imagine a generation ago, in part because of social media, because of the collaborations that they can much easier make with their counterparts in the U.S., but also in Europe, as well as in Asia and Latin America, and they're doing that.
Professor Michael Dorsey is director of the Climate Justice Research Project.
51 years ago this week, Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba was assassinated shortly after the Congo won independence. The Belgians years ago apologized to the Congolese people. The U.S. is also widely believed to have played a role in Lumumba's murder. But Kambale Musavuli of Friends of the Congo says there's never been a hint of apology from the United States.
They haven't even gotten close to that, the closest we've ever gotten to even the U.S. mentioning the situation with Patrice Lumumba is the Church Committee report, which documented information about Dwight Eisenhower giving the order to assassinate Lumumba with the CIA back in July of 1960, literally a month after he became Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's going to be a long battle. Every time I think about the assassination of Lumumba, I always think about his children, who are alive today, who every year on this date, they think about the murderers of their father, who are still running around the world with total impunity. So as we commemorate that day, you know, we are thinking about the family, we're thinking about the Congolese people, the stifling of the democratic aspiration of the Congolese people on that day, and also reminding the youth of the Congo today the resilience of young Congolese back in 1960. You know, Lumumba was 35 years old when he was assassinated, a very young man who had a great future for our nation. So we're reminding the youth of that as well.
Congolese democracy was stifled 51 years ago with the murder of Lumumba. It was also stifled this year, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And there's still no world outcry. You know, we just had a few months ago, November 28th, second election since the beginning of the war in 1996. So the elections was definitely a sham election. What we have seen from the international community is statements such as there were irregularities, there was lack of credibility to the process. So let me put that in context to you. What is the lack of credibility? In Kinshasa, the capital city, more than 2,000 polling stations were not counted. So let me give it to an American context. Think about an American voter waking up in the morning, going to vote, and then they tell him that your vote was not even counted, and they call that irregularity. So that's really the disenfranchisement of the Congolese, that right now in the United States, I'm seeing the NAACP fighting for the disenfranchisement of black voters in America. And that's what happened to black in Congo right now. Congolese have exercised their fundamental rights that is listed in the Declaration of Human Rights, the right to vote, that who they voted for did not win, or even not even at the level that their vote was not even counted. So that's the outrage of what has taken place with the election. And that's the call now for people around the world to be at the side of the Congolese. And I always remind people, the struggle in the Congo is a tough one. Congolese are resilient. It's taking them quite a while to be able to stop the exploitation in the country. But with the support of ordinary people all around the world, it can come up fast. I'm always reminded of the struggle of the, to end apartheid. But now when you look at back then, what happened was that Reagan vetoed the anti-apartheid bill. Even the U.S. president was not ready to let go of South Africa. He vetoed the bill when it came to his desk. But because of a two-third majority in the U.S. Congress, that became law. Ronald Reagan had to sign that and say, no, apartheid has to end and the U.S. is not going to support that. Right now, it's the same thing. I do believe, firmly believe, that the United States government is supporting a dictatorial regime in the Congo. And that's the regime of Joseph Kabila, who was declared the winner of the election. Now, while Congolese are screaming, are organizing protests all around the world, they did protests in Cyprus. They're doing it in many cities in the United States. They're doing it in Canada. They are even protesting in Israel. With all these protests of Congolese denouncing the fraudulent election of 2011, November 2011, we have yet seen a bold statement from the administration of Barack Obama denouncing the sham election. Now, we see that how they are denouncing the election in Russia. I mean, the Congo is very clear. It's being documented. You know, the Carter Center published a report on the election, and the statement was for lack of credibility. The Catholic Church, which deploy 30,000 observers inside of the country, we have 60,000 polls, so they had almost half of the country there. They even said that the result does not reflect neither truth nor justice. The European Union said the same thing, but they are not bold not to support that. Why? Because the regime right now in the Congo protects international interests, foreign interests. What happened on December 27? Well, Kabila held his word. You know, he gave the word to the French that I will give you an oil block if I stay president. He was declared the winner on December 27. He signed a decree giving an oil block in one of the lakes in the Congo, Lake Albert, to a French oil company called Total. So we see that the international community, led by the United States, are putting forward profits over the people rather than looking at what the people have to benefit from their country and the exercise of their rights. So our call remains the same. We will never put our faith in world government. We always put our faith in the people because we know what the people have done. The people have organized for people around the world, and our call is to them to stand in solidarity with Congolese on January 17th as we celebrate the brutal assassination of Patrice Lumumba.
On Tuesday, on the anniversary, you're going to have a rally at Lafayette Park. That's right across the street from the White House. What will you be saying to the White House?
Well, 51 years later, they still have not recognized the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. A young Congolese can name a few names of people involved. Even one of them, Larry Devlin, wrote a book about it, explaining that. We do know that the United States government has had policies in Africa, specifically in the Congo, that support strong men rather than supporting the institutions and the people. So 51 years ago, Lumumba was assassinated because he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the Congolese people. The United States was not okay with that. And as Hillary Clinton stated herself, that sometime when we had leaders who did not abide by our interests, sometime we got rid of them. That came from her. She said it a few months ago on PBS. So we are denouncing that U.S. support. That's why we're going to the White House, telling the American people that White House has a president who is not holding on to his word. He went to Ghana. He spoke to the Africans. He told them, you can't have elections here and sprinkle some elections there and call that democracy. He said that. So we just had another sprinkled election in the Congo, and he's deadly silent, completely silent about it. But the American people do not know that he has sweet talks. So we are reminding the American people that this situation in the Congo, it is so critical to the future of Africa. If Congo is not free, Africa cannot be free. And the American people need to know the policies that are perpetrated on the African continent through militarism to Africa, through mining exploitation, corporate exploitation there, through support of our strongmen and dictators. The American people need to know how the tax money is being used so that children under the age of 5 can be massacred in the Congo. So that the women who are demonstrating, now can you imagine calling these women, went to demonstrate in front of the U.S. Embassy and occupied the U.S. Embassy in Kinshasa, had a sit-in there. They came and beat them by the police of the Congo. Why am I even mentioning this situation? The Congolese police just received $500,000 worth of police gear from the United States on November 15, 2011. In December, they used it against the Congolese women inside of the embassy, demanding that the U.S. denounce the elections. We have not heard a word from Ambassador Entwistle, who is the U.S. ambassador in the Congo. We have not heard anyone in the State Department denouncing the Congolese police beating Congolese women on U.S. embassy land or territory. A complete silence when it comes to the killing of Congolese civilians by a U.S. ally today, which is the Congo and the Congolese president, Kabila. So that's what we are doing. We are going to denounce U.S. foreign policy toward Africa, and specifically toward the Congo.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.